Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'll be reading today were published by the Geographic Society in August of 2025. I'll begin with this article, titled, "Rat Kings May Actually Be Real, But It's Nothing to Laugh About." The phenomenon is when a pack of rats become entangled by their tails, unable to separate themselves. We ask experts to weigh in on whether it is really possible. By Jason Bittle. Since at least the 1500s, people have been mesmerized by the legend of the so-called Rat King. Usually depicted as a mass of rodents with their tails tied in a knot, the specific details can vary by the telling. In some stories, the group is led by one rat that directs the rest, perhaps with psychological powers, while in others the whole group works together, like some kind of amalgamated monster. In one version or another, the Rat King, which can refer to the whole group of animals, or simply the dominant rat, is an idea that has appeared in all forms of pop culture. But is there any truth to the Rat King legend? Some experts have argued that historical Rat King discoveries could have been hoaxes, although they couldn't rule out the possibility that such a thing is physically possible. Meanwhile, others are convinced. The Rat King is not a legend, argues Andre Miljutin, curator at the University of Tartu Natural History Museum in Estonia, in an email. In contrast to gods and humanoids, everyone can see and study rat kings at museums in different countries. Some of them are housed in the very building where I am writing this message. However, Miljutin, who says rats are his favorite animal, and that he somewhat fell into studying rat kings, stresses that the discovery of one is nothing to celebrate. Indeed, it is a death sentence. The animals suffer from permanent pain. They cannot move around normally to find food and water, and what is worse, they are helpless, he says. What is a rat king? In a 2007 study published in the journal Proceedings of the Estonian Academy of Sciences, Miljutin found that before 2005, there were 58 rat king sightings he deemed reliable, though just 6 of these were preserved in museums. Interestingly, some common themes emerged. With the exception of one rat king documented on the island of Java in Indonesia, all the rat kings were from the same species, the black rat, or Rattus rattus. Most were identified in Germany, France, Poland, the Netherlands, and Belgium, and findings often seem to coincide with spates of cold weather. Therefore, Miljutin concluded that rat kings are most likely to occur in areas where both cold winters and black rats are found. As for how the tails of the rats become entangled, it seems true rat kings are not a result of knotting, but rather the product of some other sticky material. In one case Miljutin investigated in South Estonia in 2021, he says, the knot of tails looked like a large ball due to the incorporation of a mixture of clay soil, poultry manure, straw, and feathers. Interestingly, those rats were still alive by the time Miljutin got to them. This makes him one of the very few people known to have seen a living Rat King phenomenon in person. The local news channel even captured video of the 13 tangled up black rats, all young rats of both sexes. How Rat Kings Could Happen. As an urban rodentologist of more than 30 years, who has even been described as the Rat King of New York himself, Bobby Corrigan has come across this legend more than once. I have been asked in the press several times about Rat Kings, and I always reply I have not personally witnessed it in my long career, says Corrigan, who spent 16 years teaching at Purdue University and is now a consultant for RMC Pest Management Consulting. But after reviewing Mole Jutin's evidence, Corrigan says he's convinced. For sure it is real, but it is rare, he says, or at least rare to us humans, maybe not to the long-tailed rats of the world. There are also several aspects of rodent behavior and anatomy Corrigan has seen firsthand that align with what would be necessary to create a rat king. Rats have a behavior where they all get together in very tiny spaces in walls and ground burrows. It's called hugger-muggering, says Corrigan. They all get really close together to exchange body heat because they don't hibernate. Similarly, Corrigan says rat tails are composed of cartilage, which makes them very flexible, and many rat species use their tails to curl around branches to provide some extra grip. However, rat tails cannot be tied into a knot, he says. Finally, while he finds it unlikely any trapped rodents would obey a master and function as one, rats do establish hierarchies, similar to primates or canines. Often there will be a dominant male that mates with all the females and keeps a territory, says Corrigan. So is there a dominant rat in the area where there is a social structure, and could you call that rat king? Yes. While rats and rat kings might seem frightening, especially as they're portrayed in pop culture, Corrigan says he takes a different point of view. We probably owe 20, maybe 30, additional years to our own life expectancy to rats, he says. We've tested every single cancer drug in the world on them, every pharmaceutical, and we continue to do so. These animals are a tremendous benefit to humankind, says Corrigan. And that completes the first article, titled Rat Kings Might Actually Be Real, But It's Nothing to Laugh About, by Jason Bittle. This next article's title is The Gory History of Europeans Eating Mummies for Health. Here's why medieval Europeans believed medical cannibalism was a cure-all. It's written by Aaron Blakemore. Eating mammals may sound unthinkable, but in 15th century Europe, this type of medical cannibalism was touted as the remedy for headaches, stomach ailments, and even cancer. For centuries, embalmed bodies were prized across the continent, not for their historical value, but for their purported medical benefits. Here's the surprising reason that people once craved and ate mummies. How did people start eating mummies? The history of corpse medicine, the practice of consuming parts of ancient Egyptian mummies, and later embalmed corpses of all kinds, began in the 11th century. What started it all, writes historian Carl Dannenfeldt, was a series of mistranslations and misunderstandings. The gory story hinges on one word, mumia. Prized for its healing qualities, mumia was a substance found on a single Persian mountainside, where it seeped from black rock asphalt. Named after the local word for wax, mum, the substance was used for a variety of medical purposes and gained a reputation in the Arabic world as expensive, precious, and effective. But when Western Europeans began encountering the Islamic world and translating its texts, a single mistranslation led to widespread confusion about the meaning of mumia. According to Dannenfeldt, a variety of 11th and 12th century translators incorrectly identified mumia as a substance exuded from preserved bodies in Egyptian tombs. Part of the confusion came from the word mummy's similarity to the word mummy, and also the fact that some ancient Egyptian mummies were embalmed using asphalt. Scientists now know that only some mummies were made with that process. But Western Europeans, fascinated by ancient finds in Egypt, ran with the concept, and mummia became associated with embalmed bodies, instead of precious asphalt from a Persian mountain. What is medical cannibalism? Mistranslation and medical misunderstandings now combined with another fallacious but long-standing belief that the human body contained healing power that could cure other humans of various ailments. For generations, humans had practiced what is now known as medical cannibalism in a bid for better health. From the belief that gladiators' blood could heal epilepsy, to the use of human fat in homemade remedies, medical cannibalism was alive and well in medieval Western Europe. Even King Charles II is said to have sipped from a tincture called the King's Drops, containing human skulls. With the arrival of mumia, by then also called mummy, medical practitioners believed they'd hit upon a new source of healing products made from human body parts. Mumia was prescribed for everything, from headaches to heart attacks, and a run on mummies followed. Suddenly, people were ransacking Egyptian tombs, not just for jewelry or pottery, but for the bodies within, and canny salesmen began collecting and selling mummies. Demand quickly outpaced supply, leading to a brisk trade in fake mummies. Body snatchers and unethical tradespeople began turning fresh cadavers and the human remains of executed criminals, enslaved people, and others into, quote, mummies, in an attempt to capitalize on the craze. Body snatchers would steal by night the bodies of such as were hanged, wrote one observer, who noted the bodies were often embalmed with salt and drugs, dried in an oven, then ground into powder that apothecaries added to their home remedies. Victorians and Egyptomania. Though skepticism about mummia grew throughout the centuries, the fascination with mummies only rose. Egyptomania was so pronounced in England during the Victorian era that mummy unwrapping became a popular pastime in lecture halls and hospitals. They were even held in private homes in the 19th century as British men returned home from archaeological expeditions, colonial postings, or sightseeing tours with human mummies they looted from Egyptian tombs. Despite a ban on the export of antiquities, Europeans continued seeking out mummies both to satisfy their curiosity and provide components for medical remedies. It wasn't until the late 19th century that the use of mummia finally died off. Still, the world's fascination with ancient Egyptian remedies remains. For proof, just look at the skin care shelf in your local store, where magic creams and other skin cream items use ancient Egyptian motifs in their advertising material. We no longer resort to mummy eating or medical cannibalism to stay healthy, but the mystique of ancient Egypt remains as strong as ever. And that completes the article titled "The Gory History of Europeans Eating Mummies for Health" by Aaron Blakemore. The next article is titled "Appendix Cancer is Rare, but it has quadrupled in millennials." Experts are still trying to pinpoint what's driving a rise in new cases among young adults. We're just at the tip of the iceberg for this disease. By Danielle Zickel. Most people only think about their appendix if it needs to be removed, but a worrying new trend is rewriting this narrative, as appendix cancer is on the rise in younger generations. A study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in June found the rates of the disease has tripled among Gen X and quadrupled among millennials compared to people who were born in the 1940s. For the study, researchers looked at a large database called the National Cancer Institute's SEER program, which collects cancer data from various registries across the U.S. They created 21 overlapping birth cohorts, or groups of people born within a certain 8-year span. These groups started with people born between 1891 and 1899 and went all the way up to people born between 1991 and 1999. The results? More than 4,800 people ages 20 and older were diagnosed with appendix cancer between 1975 and 2019. The incidence rate of appendix cancer for those born in 1980 was 3.41 times higher than those born in 1945. And the incident rate of appendix cancer for those born in 1985 was 4.62 times higher than those born in 1945. It's important to note that in the grand scheme of things, appendix cancer is rare. We estimate about 3,000 new cases of appendix cancer are diagnosed every year, says study author Andriana Holawatai, assistant professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. For comparison, the National Cancer Institute estimates there will be nearly 320,000 new cases of breast cancer, the most common type of cancer in the U.S., in 2025. But one thing is clear. We're just at the tip of the iceberg for this disease, Holawati says. We're working to begin to unpack the risk factors because these rising trends will be important to understand what's driving the increase in this disease. Why appendix cancer is on the rise in younger generations. Appendiceal cancer occurs when the cells in your appendix, a little appendage that hangs off your colon on the lower right side of your abdomen, mutate and grow uncontrollably, resulting in a tumor. When appendix cancer is localized to the appendix, it is easier to cure compared to when it spreads to other organs, says Christopher G. Kahn, assistant professor with a focus on gastrointestinal cancers at Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia. Doctors and researchers are still trying to pinpoint why the rates of appendix cancer are increasing in people under 50. But the stats are consistent with other gastrointestinal cancers like colon cancer and rectal cancer, according to Kahn. The big question here is what has changed across generations, Holawati says. She points out that one change has been an increase in processed and ultra-processed foods. These contain food additives and pollutants, which studies suggest may cause chronic inflammation. As a 2024 study published in Gut found, chronic inflammation plays a key role in the growth and progression of colorectal cancer. Kahn's theory is similar. The incidence of appendix cancer may be the result of cumulative exposure to environmental factors, such as microplastics and ultra-processed foods, over the course of someone's lifetime, from in utero all the way up until diagnosis. Lifestyle factors such as smoking, alcohol consumption, and lack of exercise may contribute as well, he says. Laura A. Lambert, professor of surgery and director of the peritoneal malignancy program at the University of Utah, who specializes in appendiceal cancer, speculates the cause is linked to the gut microbiome, the bacteria that live in our intestines and are part of our normal digestive system. We do think the appendix might function as a reservoir for healthy bacteria, she says. The theory is that appendix cancer may occur when these good bacteria are somehow replaced by bad bacteria. Lambert suspects the same environmental and lifestyle factors Can highlighted could be responsible for those gut microbiome changes. But nobody's actually figured that out to be able to pull them all together and see if there's a common denominator, Lambert says. The problem with screening for appendix cancer. It's recommended to begin screening for colorectal cancer with a colonoscopy at age 45, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, while mammograms to screen for breast cancer should start at age 40. By contrast, there are no screenings for appendiceal cancer for anyone of any age, according to both Holowatai and Lambert. A disease has to be of a certain prevalence within the population to make it worthwhile, Lambert says. There's no cheap way of screening for appendix cancer. CT scans don't have enough high sensitivity and specificity. When you do a colonoscopy, you don't actually see into the appendix. Not to mention, she adds, tumor markers, substances in your blood or urine, often proteins, that appear in higher amounts when cancer is present, are not reliable enough, and the incidence is so low that there's no way that the government would support screening for this disease. Without screening, Lambert says, appendix cancer doesn't really let you know it's there until you have symptoms, and even then it may be difficult to diagnose. In fact, most people find out they have appendix cancer after getting an appendectomy, when their appendix is removed and examined under a microscope, Holowatai says. But this isn't just a case of finding more appendix cancer because we're removing more appendixes. Holowatai cites a study published in Cancer that shows the rate of appendectomies have actually remained stable over the years, which she says makes the rising rates of appendix cancer even more alarming. Why symptoms are so confusing. Common signs of appendix cancer include stomach pain, feeling bloated, nausea and vomiting, and feeling full soon after starting to eat, according to the National Cancer Institute. However, some of these symptoms could be indicative of other GI issues, like irritable bowel syndrome, for instance. If a younger person complains to their primary care doctor of these symptoms, the odds are low they'll automatically assume appendix cancer. Most physicians, if they've ever seen a case of it, might only see one or two in their entire career, Lambert says. By the time the cancer is caught, it may already be in the later stages and harder to treat. Awareness needs to increase in physicians, Can says. If someone is having rectal bleeding, we can't just assume hemorrhoids. If someone is having persistent constipation, we can't just assume it's dietary. Referral to a GI specialist who can do a thorough evaluation is what's needed. Holowatai agrees. I think it's really important for providers and general practitioners to be mindful of this increase in appendix cancer cases, particularly in younger patients. And when they see a young patient presenting with these symptoms, work to rule it out, she says. Knowledge and education of this rare disease is a challenge overall. Experts agree it's going to be difficult to reverse the rising numbers of appendix cancer without identifying a definitive cause. I am certainly hopeful that the factors we discover will be ones where effective interventions can decrease appendiceal cancer incidence and begin to reverse these trends, if they were to be lifestyle or environmental factors, for example. But that will be the crucial information to help us understand next steps forward, Holawati said. Until then, Lambert emphasizes the importance of advocating for yourself if you have a family history of appendix cancer or are experiencing unexplained symptoms. Reach out to reputable organizations that are dedicated to education, research, and support for this disease, and really advocate for yourself. Don't settle. Get to the specialists. And that completes the article. The title was, Appendix Cancer is Rare, but it has quadrupled in millennials. It was written by Danielle Zickel. And that completes the broadcast today. We have run out of time. You've been listening to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sunsounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sunsounds volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you found it informative. All of the articles I read today were published in August of 2025. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sunsounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.